Welcome to Confessions of a CEO powered by RG. My name is Carl Swansbury, and I'm delighted today to welcome Mark Dixon onto my podcast. Mark is an incredibly interesting and very successful businessman. He started his former career with Rolls-Royce here in the Northeast before setting up his own business, Promenax, which went through two private equity transactions prior to being sold to Castaigne for tens of millions. Mark since then tried to retire, failed significantly to do so, and as a consequence has worked with many businesses as interim chair, non-exec director, and more recently, interim CEO. It's going to be brilliant today to understand a little bit more about Mark's why, what inspires him to want to work with boards, shareholder groups, and management teams, and also perhaps to get a little bit under the skin of how Mark may have gone about building his own business differently, given the knowledge, skills, and hindsight he now has. I certainly think today's podcast is going to be incredibly interesting, and we really hope you, as our viewers, are able to take something away. Mark, thank you so much for agreeing to join me today on my Confessions of a CEO / NXT podcast. Really appreciate in advance your time.
No problem.
So I guess before we talk a little bit about your more recent business career, it would be fantastic if we could just go right back to the beginning, Mark, because of course, like me, you have very strong northern roots, right? So it would be awesome to understand a bit more about, I guess, your early education, Mark.
Yeah, okay. So it's a long story because I'm old.
We've got to take it.
No problem. I was born in Gateshead, the Queen Elizabeth, and lived in Dunstan for a good part of my childhood. And then my father was lucky enough to get a job in Ashington, and we moved up to Warkworth, which was
beautiful.
Bedilling. So, I mean, it still is. It's very popular now, but it was a great place to grow up, great place to meet my wife, have my children there and bring them up. My education, I went to school in Amble, and the options back then from a careers advisor point of view was, you can go down the pit or you can go on the farm. And I didn't fancy either. And I decided to go to Ashton Technical College. And they did a course, an ordinary national diploma in engineering technology, which meant that you could really, if you chose to go to university, could pick any discipline within engineering. It was that broad church. And I did quite well. And I actually got headhunted, which is unusual from a university perspective. And I was invited to apply to study nuclear engineering in Manchester. And the reason being, so this would be late 70s, 78, government were pushing for a big nuclear program. There was a distinct lack of nuclear engineers. Mm. So they said, do you fancy coming to study in nuclear engineering? And I said, yes. It was a bone of contention with my parents, who were members of Greenpeace, and were trying to stop the proposed new build of a nuclear power station at Druridge Bay.
Interesting.
But anyway, went on the course, and we were the second year intake, and it was just too difficult. They weren't really educating engineers, they were trying to produce scientists, because we studied reactor physics. So I came back home, tail between legs, and did a mechanical engineering degree at what was then the Polytechnic, Northumbria University now. And then just fell into working for Babcock, south of Renfrew, into the power game. And my first job was on a new build nuclear power station.
Because you've said a lot there, which I'd love to unpack, Mark, if that's okay. So when you sat down with your parents and not only told them that you were moving away from home.
Yeah.
But when you told them you were going to be doing when you moved away from home, how did they genuinely respond?
It was mixed. I think my dad was amazed that from Ashton Tech College you could embark on such a career. My mother was less amazed, in as much as she was quite motivated, shall we say, of stopping nuclear power stations in that sort of beautiful region, really, which was Druridge Bay. So it was a bit mixed. I ended up in the nuclear business right up until my business, which we'll talk about in due course, did a lot of work in that sector. Yeah.
And what did your parents do professionally?
So my father was a factory manager of the biggest cake decoration manufacturer in the world.
Wow.
And that was in Ashington.
Yeah.
Incredible place.
Was that really his only job for most of his career?
It's where he finished his career, basically. Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, it was an awesome place. Still there. I think it's owned by somebody different now.
Right.
The export all over the world. It was quite wrenching.
And so obviously to do what you did takes a lot of self-belief, a lot of confidence, will to want to live independently. So just tell me, you know, who do you get those traits from? Is that your father, your mum, or is it just whom you are?
No, my parents were quite gregarious individuals. Aside from his professional career, my father was an artist. And my mother was his nude model.
And you to disclose that much.
Well, it's publicly known back in the day, but they were just different. I mean, their appreciation of the classics, music, and art. I got all of that you really had to keep to yourself a wee bit, because in the environments I lived in, school in Amwell and then a tech college in Ashington, it wasn't something you sort of broadcast widely that. Or appreciation of that sort of art.
Yeah.
So you had to be careful. But they were quite gregarious. I think a lot of it stems from that, basically.
Yes.
But in terms of confidence, I think you start off not too confident, but then as your career develops and builds, I think confidence is just a byproduct of whatever path you choose, really.
Yeah. So tell me, after education, what did your first employed role involved and looked like more?
So I was ostensibly in repair and maintenance, of a big steam raising power plant. So it was everything from traditional fossil fired power stations to nuclear power stations, petrochem. So it was quite a broad church, but fundamentally thermal steam raising engineering, basically. And that's how I ended up at Rolls Royce, which was the pivotal part of my career.
And that's where you spend most of your early years, right?
With Babcocks, just around power stations around the Midlands.
Yeah. And of course, you were doing a lot of traveling at that time, right? So just talk to me a little bit about how that reconciled with home life and this appetite for balance, which we all sort of
for. So I've been married 43 years, and that early part of my career, because we ended up having three children that Angela ostensibly looked after herself, basically. So she's a very strong woman. Because working away in that environment back in those days, when you take a power station down to do its annual refurbishment, you tend to do it in a 3-month period. So you work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day
for
that 3-month period. So you're away from home virtually the whole 3 months. You get the odd weekend off. I did that for a number of years. And the money was good, and as much as you got paid overtime, double time on a Saturday and a Sunday. So you did what you had to do in terms of supporting a family and, working away from home. So my wife always tells me, because we've got grandchildren now, and you always remark on how quickly they develop and what they're learning. And she says, of course, you missed all that, didn't you, with our children? So I get reminded about it regularly.
Yeah. And, whilst she's doing that in jest and to poke fun.
Oh, Dev, yeah.
And just a question on that, though, because it's definitely something that I think any professional who's highly ambitious has to deal with. Because, hey, as you say, on one hand, you were focused on advancing your career to create financial independence for your family.
Yep.
But actually, sometimes all your kids want is a bit of time with you.
Yep.
So how did you manage to, in your own mind, justify that being away was the right thing for the family?
Money was a big driver, to be fair. But then what you then do is you overcompensate. And I've done that ever since. I'm spoiling them now. And two of them are in their 40s, for God's sakes.
Yes.
So yeah, it's just a balancing act between driving selfishly, because when put my hands up, and overcompensating when you can, holidays or the old weekend. Yeah, that's how you do it.
And not to dwell too much on this, but it's a really important point for any person who's trying to achieve, be it in their own business, be it professionally, as an employee in a larger business. Did you feel at that physical time when you were working away from home that you were making a sacrifice? Did it feel as if, you know, you were missing out on seeing the kids grow? Or actually at that time, did it not feel like that?
I've mentioned the word selfish. Yeah, definitely selfish was.
Well, you are?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Back then I was, yeah. Career was very important. So was the earning. I felt it was the right thing to do at the time. Looking back, I think when I look at how many colleagues, marriages suffered, I was pretty lucky in as much as, you know, I had a wife that was strong enough to cope with it.
Yes.
But that was luck.
Yeah. So with hindsight, would you have done anything differently when it came to, you know, working away extensively, Mark, or was that necessary at that time?
It was necessary at that time. Today, you wouldn't do it.
Right.
Because one, you wouldn't be allowed to work those sort of hours and that sort of intensity. Oh, good God. Well, it just wouldn't be allowed from a health and safety point of view.
Yes.
You know, you cannot work for 3 months, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And it was, you know, it was full on. You just wouldn't be allowed to do it, man.
Okay. So we'll probably come back to your self-admission, which is you once upon a time were selfish. We'll come back to that if you don't mind, but for now, let's just leave that there. So obviously had a very successful career within Rolls-Royce, a very large engineering business, which is, you know, highly regarded internationally.
Yeah.
When did you start to conclude that perhaps being an employee in a big corporate might not be your ultimate destination professionally?
Well, dwelling on the Rolls-Royce piece, I got headhunted. I don't think I've ever applied for a job, but that's by the by. I got headhunted, and back then, Rolls-Royce owned the NEI group of companies. And the company I got headhunted to was the only one that wasn't based in the Northeast. It was based in Derby. It was the Boilermaker. So the biggest challenge then was to say to my wife, right, we've got to move for all three children all the way down to Derby. We actually ended up in Leicestershire.
And that was the kids that...
Oh, good God. So none of them were in their teens. Jonathan's probably the best one to gauge. I think he was only 3 or 4.
Oh, okay.
And he's now 36, 37. So, yeah, so they were very young. And then to add insult to injury, we got down there, and within a year of me joining Rolls-Royce, 2 years possibly, they told me I had to do an MBA. Rolls-Royce sponsored their own MBAs, and I flatly refused because I had a huge portfolio, moved the family, a lot of pressure. And the HR guy, Brendan Casey, bless him, said, you haven't got a choice, Mark. It's a privilege to be offered this opportunity. You can't say no. So I said, well, all right, then. I know you do two MBAs. One of them's at Loughborough, just down the road from me.
That's right. That'll be convenient. It's living in
Perth. He says, no, the one you've got to do, that's for the aerospace managers. The one you've got to do is in Newcastle. So you think, oh, my God, you know, I've just moved 250-odd miles, and now I've got to go and study at Newcastle University. And it was every fifth week in term time, 3 days in a classroom for 3 years. It was a game changer. I resisted it. But once we got onto the course, you realize what a broad church it was and what their intention was to convert engineers into businessmen.
Yeah,
face a car. And I didn't see that initially.
Okay.
But then did see it. I sort of moved at a higher level than I was paid for amongst the directors. And Rolls-Royce, just about that time, it will be about 96... 97, had decided to sell the cash cow that was NEI because the Trent had literally taken off and all these businesses were being sold. And my business, International Combustion, was being sold and it went to the French Alstom.
Yeah.
In my dissertation that I had to produce for the MBA, I wrote a business plan. I did a study on what business plans meant to various different people. And wrote a business plan that basically, it was in the appendix, and it was a dummy company that took advantage of the privatization of the CGB. And basically, all it concentrated on was the fact that in that privatization, I think if you read the history books, they got rid of something like 4/5 of the human resource when they privatized it, which meant they started outsourcing everything. So from an engineering base, this business plan said, if you're willing to order a real broad church of offerings, you can create a unique business model that capitalizes on economies of scale, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay.
And that was it. It was an appendix. Excuse me. We just approved what was born in an MBA class. The company was called Promenex. Professional management through excellence.
Okay.
Couldn't be cornier.
That only you coined on an MBA program.
And then I got challenged by my peer group to say, why don't you go and start that company? Surely not. And just a series of circumstances enabled me to raise enough money to start the company up. I got a bank manager to agree to lend me up back equity. I got some business angels that lent me, I think it was about 350,000. The bank lent me 350,000, and I actually started the business.
Yeah. So, a few questions. To that point, you'd been an employee.
Yep.
In a big corporate.
Yeah.
How did you know what was required to sit opposite investors and to credibly seek investment?
Mm.
How did you know that? Because there's no playbook for
There's not. And the MBA was instrumental in sort of opening your mind to the art of the possible. Yeah. I was very confident of the sector I was in.
Yeah.
I was very conscious of the changes that were happening as a consequence of that privatization.
Yeah.
And the two things just knitted together. I mean, it was a hell of a shock for my wife.
Yeah.
When the packet came through the through the front door, and it said Promenex, and it didn't say Rolls Royce. And
how involved was she in the decision to resign safe employment to set up a business that you'd never really had any first-hand experience of doing before?
She wasn't.
Yeah. Again, told her you were doing this rather than self for her input.
Selfishly. But it's a different generation. Some of the guys I took with me, really young guys, who I consequently put through that same MBA course, when I watched how they shared that information with their wives, they told them everything. And Angela only found out what was going in the business when she went to the Christmas party, just because their wives would tell her. And she would say, Mark, how do they know so much more than I do about the business? And I said, well, that's because I chose not to share it with you. And it was that it was a conscious decision to keep my family life separate from the business.
Separation.
Totally. Because it keeps you sane in terms of, it's a very lonely place to borrow that sort of money back in those days, set up a business, take people with you who eventually have mortgages and have their own kids, and you begin to realize the enormity of the task once you get into it.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's when you've got to make these conscious decisions. How the hell do you keep yourself sane when embarking on something of that scale?
Huh.
And you know, maintain, which has always been the case, a very happy home life.
So for you, it is about having quite a separate home life and business life. And that gives you your sanity, your ability to put things into the boxes.
Yeah. And Angela, bless her, understood it. I'm sure it frustrated her hell, but she understood the separation.
Sure.
And supported me. So, okay. And again, that's very important.
So on day one of new business, was it just you, or did you take people from Rolls-Royce to join you in the business?
There was two people, two colleagues that I'd worked with previously were there. And I took two or three guys from Rolls-Royce with me. And we rented some wonderful offices in a suite of barns near a farm. I got them all really good cars, like BMWs, because when you're trying to set up a business pitching with big utilities, you've got to give this impression, excuse me, that you're a lot bigger than you actually are.
Yeah.
Yeah? And therefore, you can't turn up in the back of an old van.
Oh,
and
well, we take it serious.
Absolutely. So I took a big gamble, but we won, God, probably £7 or 8 million worth of orders in the first year.
And were these on the traded pre-existing relationships you
had? Totally, yeah.
Okay, so that gave you the confidence to probably decide
for business. We traded nearly $3 million of it in the first year.
Wow, incredible from the standing start. And did those clients give you that assurance pre you setting up the business? I'm just trying to work out where this confidence to set up the business came from.
I found a few mavericks who ended up being good friends, of course.
Yes.
Who were willing to sort of, it wasn't a cartel, so don't pick it up the wrong way, but there were two or three dominant companies in that sector. Yeah. And they were expensive. Oh. And we basically gave them a buy one, get one free offer.
Sure.
And because we knew that we could do it. And so this utility was PowerGen. And it was in King's North and Kent.
Okay.
And they went for it. And, Gary Ulett, who was the engineering manager, is retired now. Very good friend. And, it was a maverick. Yeah.
So, obviously, you walk away from Rolls-Royce and everything that comes with that. New business, you and the small team. Were you the only shareholder at that point?
No. No, I shared the equity out. Well, with the business angels, we didn't have any equity. They had 100%, and that's how business angels work. And they didn't have terribly deep pockets. And when I approached venture capitalists, because it was a service business, so no assets, no technology, no product as such, they said, well, we like the research that you've done, and we understand the concept, but we really need some sort of critical mass to hang our coat on or to write a check. And within that first year, it worked. And therefore, I pulled off a management buyout with the Nashcell and Partners. Sorry about this frog in my throat. And they're now called Sovereign Capital. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And they wrote me a check.
London.
That's right. Yeah, in Buckingham Gate.
Yes.
And they wrote me a check for £1 million. And I paid off the business angels. I got some 3 times the money.
Good.
Within less than 12 months. And that's when we took equity. We got 40%.
Yep. Right. So you and the team had 40% Sovereign Capital, 60%.
Yep.
Understand.
Yep.
And when you look back at the sort of first 12 months post the buyout, what would you say is the one thing that had the greatest impact on the business that you then went on to create?
We debated around appointing a chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And I advised them. I knew a chap called David Dance, who is a Geordie, was based up the coast, was big in PowerGen, had retired, and thought he'd be ideal as a board member. Great respect within the sector, et cetera, et cetera. What I hadn't appreciated was how venture capitalists work.
Mm.
And David, bless him, he was as straight as an arrow. And he once made this comment when we were getting some critique at a board meeting. And I think his phrase went along the line, given that you guys have never had proper jobs, the VC firm, and he was...
By that he meant you've never worked in industry, whereby there's a service or a product for us.
So he hadn't really appreciated the nuances of how you chair a business in the VC investment. They were... rightly so offended in terms of those sort of comments.
No.
And then that whole education starts, wow, this is a different sort of relationship than the business relationships that you're used to. Yeah. And that is an entirely different story. I mean, the education in terms of, and influence is what I do now, of course, of how VC firms operate. And they're all similar, but different.
Yes, right.
And it's that where I bring value to businesses now, by interpreting the relationship between the investors and the target
companies. Stakeholder management.
With diplomacy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, obviously, you were now, along with your colleagues, 40% shareholders in a business of first tie. You're building value for you versus building value for others. Talk me through, fundamentally, Mark, what you achieve with that business.
Well, we went through a secondary buyout. Sovereign Capital sort of fell out of love with us in terms of not so much the predictability of the business, but the returns they thought we were going to get weren't as high as they wanted. We were a 12% margin business.
Okay.
A lot of our work, our transactional work, was open book.
Yep.
So you weren't going to get much more than that anyway.
Yeah.
But there was steady revenue. We had a balance between one-off project, high risk, higher margin, but stable annual work.
Mm.
That was probably 70% of the business, where because it was transparent, open book, you were only ever going to make 12%. And I think that sort of diminished the multiples that you were going to get. And Sovereign just weren't interested. Fortunately, NVM were. And we pulled off a secondary buyout, mid-80s, I think it was. Yeah, probably later. And they got it. They were prepared for that journey. And they got out in 2011. So, yeah, it was early 20s then. And they got a good return on their investment. And we sold it.
The business.
Well, by then we had annual sales of something like 70 million with about 1,500 employees.
Oh, big business.
Which is a sizable business, yeah.
And is that when you fundamentally took your value off the table?
We all did, yeah.
Yeah.
So we've sold to Costain in 2011. I stopped with Costain for a couple of years to help them integrate the business. And then I tried retirement.
Before we talk about retirement.
Yeah, because
or your attempted retirement.
Yeah, exactly.
In terms of the feeling and the emotions around selling a business, of course, you know, you've talked a lot about
14 years.
What was involved in starting up, scaling up, bringing in different equity sponsors at different times.
Mm.
Can you just talk to me a little bit about genuinely what it felt like when you sold your shares in the business that you founded?
The list you just give me is spot on, but you miss one element, and that was the growth and development of about four or five individuals that I brought with me.
Yeah, quite young. The leadership team, presumably.
Well, they weren't then. They ended up as the leadership team, but back then they were middle management.
Mm-hmm.
But I chose to invest in them quite heavily. And educate them. You know, if that MBA was good enough for me, I think in the end, I put five of them through the same MBA.
Oh, really?
MBA at Caicastle, which was a big ask for an SME.
That's right.
You know, I was questioned quite heavily by the backers.
Yep.
And I kept stressing to them, and this is something I can relate to where I'm advising companies now, particularly if you're a service business, the intrinsic value has got to be in not just first-tier management, second-tier management. Because if you do take the money and leave, where's the value?
That's
so
right.
Therefore, you've first got to make yourself redundant to sell a business of that nature.
Yeah,
services. And therefore, you have to make sure that second tier becomes the first tier and is as good as, if not better.
I.e. capable of continuing
absolutely
to run the business and deliver the same level of service when the equity holders fundamentally choose or otherwise to leave.
Yeah, and that was probably the biggest thing I was proud of. But yeah, back to selling it after 14 years is
it's big.
Mm. Yeah,
totally.
My family were immensely worried how I would do that transition.
Yeah,
and it was seamless. I'd always known, because you've got that sort of backing, that these guys are going to get their money back.
That's right.
The best, the greatest value to be had was a trade sale. And it was intrinsic, really, that once a trade sale had been achieved and the integration was successful, you don't stay with the buyer. It's very rare. And of course, that's what happened. So the integration took about a couple of years. And yeah, then I parted company. And it was rather straightforward. The timing was just probably right in terms of selling it. I concentrate more on the pride I had in terms of what I've created than the fact I was leaving it.
Yes. And just to ask a question about the individuals that you had developed that were capable of running the business whilst you exiting it. Because you made a really important point there about selling the business to a trade buyer, because the belief then was that selling to a strategic trade buyer would deliver more value to the
shareholder. Absolutely.
Can you just talk a little bit about the challenge that not you faced there, but some founder CEOs may face in an instance where they want to sell a business, they develop the leadership team, and that leadership team want to buy it. But perhaps there are strategic trade buyers who will pay more to acquire the business than management perhaps can.
Yeah.
Just talk a little bit about that, please, because that's the only time where having an SLT can be a problem.
Yeah, yeah. The opportunity for the guys to indulge in an MBO wasn't really there,
right?
Because of the values. I mean, we sold it for something like, and it's in the public domain, something like 18.8 million. And I think for them, because they were still quite young when we sold,
right,
to raise that sort of money.
What's viable at that time was their tool.
So they knew there was going to be a trade sale. They knew it was going to be Costain. I can say this tongue firmly in cheek, but I knew we were going to sell to Costain probably 2 years before we did it, because they, so I researched the market quite carefully, and I distinctly remember one Christmas there was an article, and it was the then chairman of Costain stating that the company was stable and they were going to go on an acquisition spree. And immediately I thought to myself, that's who we're going to sell it to, basically.
Okay.
So that part of the journey stroke education is, how do you make that company valuable to a potential acquirer? Because it's not just window dressing. You've got to have contracts in place and concentrate on the real areas where a potential buyer can see tangible value, basically. And we did that rather well.
Yeah. And it's very rare 2 years prior to a business being sold that the founder CEO knows who the likely acquirer is.
Yep.
So just to ask, did you only prioritize that one buyer at the cost of a process where you had multiple discussions?
No. What I did was I invested quite heavily in relationships, advisors. Because here's another education, of course, you love this, that to be successful in any disposal or acquisition for that matter, you very much have to rely on your advisors. And I was in bed with the best of them. It was Deloitte. Yeah. It was a guy called Darren Bullcock. And the relationship was such, I mean, we call ourselves friends now, but if you get that advisor to invest emotionally with the business, you get, they're expensive.
You get
to point. Massive value. And another thing you've got to learn to do, because I was a strong CEO, but I was prepared to listen and take that sort of advice. You're paying that sort of money, and these guys have got such a track record, you'd be daft not to.
Totally.
So a lot of that you put in their hands, and therefore the marketing of the business, I steered them. I even told Darren, I think Costain are going to be red hot after.
But that was a full process.
Yeah, totally.
So, obviously you mentioned earlier that you, certainly in your earlier years, chose to keep your wife, your kids, your home life very distant from business.
Yeah.
Well, that's right.
Let's not forget
our four-legged friend. quite separate from business. At what point did your wife know you were selling the business? Because that's probably the first time where actually business and whole life become the same financially.
Yeah. Well, I told her that it was inevitable anyway. The timing of it was probably 2 years out that we started that journey to market the business and make sure it was in good shape to sell, basically. So, yeah.
And other than the obvious financial impact, what was your sort of wife's view of you planning to sell the business and planning to leave the business post-sale?
She was worried. I mean, I did explain she didn't know much about the business, but she loved the social side. She was an excellent CEO's wife.
Right.
In terms of mixing it, racing events. We were quite big back then. Corporate hospitality didn't have the problems it does now, whereas a lot of our customers would indulge, and they became friends. And
totally.
And Angela played the perfect part in terms of the host. She was aware that we had to sell it. She was worried about how it would affect me after 14 years hard work. But I think that worry was balanced with, well, what are you going to do? Because surely you're not contemplating retiring. And I did, and I lasted 9 months. So
let's talk about that. So obviously, you know, spent a very significant amount of time building a business, sold a business to Costain for millions of pounds, which gave you presumably financial independence.
Yeah,
no longer do you want to have a need to have to. work or be in business. So what was the thing that sort of inspired, if that's the right word, inspired you to decide retirement wasn't for you and you had to be more active than that?
When I started out in business, as it were, the subject of mental health was never discussed.
To say it
is a recent subject matter would be disingenuous, but it wasn't done back in the
well, as you said, the early 90s always existed, but it was freely discussed.
It wasn't discussed.
The thing that changed, didn't it?
And the 9 months I had off was excellent. We moved from Leicestershire, my wife and I, came home and got ourselves initially what was a holiday home up in Lowick, and Berwick, so we're in the best place in the world. And the 9 months, I remember distinctly because we had a really good summer and thoroughly enjoyed it. But then I realised that there's something missing. You know, that you can walk the dog on the beach every day, and when I could only do it at weekends, it was very special.
Yes.
When you can do it whenever you want, it takes the gloss off the way.
Well, yeah.
So, and Angela, bless her, became aware of this and said, well, you've got to get back out there. You know, you've got to start working again. And she says, fundamentally, I've put on nearly half a stone since you retired because I like to cook. And she says, I can't do that. You just go eat food and
too much pleasure.
So she says, get yourself back to work.
And just talk to me a little bit more about your reference to mental health, because you chose to reference that. Are you saying that after 9 months of walking the dog and overeating, that actually you started to mentally feel a little bit
lost
about purpose and ease, call it what you will.
I think you've got to be brave to set up a business like I did. Brave and a bit foolish. And it's quite intense.
Yeah.
It's very pressurized. It's very social. You know, we're a service business, so it was people dominated, and you do a lot of engaging with customers. So it's always on the go all the time. The isolation that I felt when we had that 9 months off was lovely to begin with.
Yeah.
But then as it went through, it was becoming an issue, I would suggest. And I really felt it's a drug, isn't it? You don't realize you live off adrenaline until it's not there.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I've got to do something. This is not good.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of founders who build and go on to sell their business do say, I need to be needed.
Yeah.
I need purpose.
Yeah.
And I think all the smart that's what you're saying, come to the realization of.
Well, this is how the selfishness manifests itself now in older life. It is, you miss that being needed. You miss adding value. And I think that's quite important to me as well.
Yeah. Let me ask a question about this, because obviously you are now a chair/non-executive director rather than a full-time CEO, which is, you know, what you once were in the business you found. So let me ask, obviously when you are building a business or building a career, you are doing so with one eye on creating wealth, because a lot of people are motivated by financial independence.
Mm-hmm.
But once you've sold a business and you've got millions in the bank, since obviously that financial motivation is different. So just to understand, what post selling the business, when you started to feel a little bit itchy about the time, what was it that was actually truly the thing that inspired you to get back into doing something that is business oriented? Because of course it wasn't the ability to earn income, of course. So what was it?
It was that desire to add value and egotistically be recognized for it.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's to be perceived by individuals as someone who is successful. Is that what you mean?
I suppose the assumption is that you get these non-exec roles because you have a track record.
Yeah. Yes.
So it's not so much that, and this is where we'll take a different direction shortly. And as much as a lot of the projects, I've been involved with probably 8 projects since I retired. Majority of them have been in turnaround situations. Yeah. Not by choice. It's just where I've ended up. And turnarounds are quite interesting in as much as, one, they're not always successful. So I've had at least one, if not two, businesses that didn't quite work out. But the ones where I have succeeded give you an immense amount of enjoyment. When you've satisfied the investor, owner, and the employees,
yeah,
and got them out of a certain problem,
yes, right,
and on the road to success, that's fun. There's no other way of describing it, really. And in having had, as I say, probably 8 projects of that nature, I mean, the last one was just epic. I think I've told you in previous conversations. I ended up exec chairman of the biggest glass recycling company in the UK. And it was on its knees in 2020, just before COVID. We'll describe it none other than senior management malfeasance. and the whole senior management team had left. Yeah.
Go on.
So we had to recreate that team. And in 2020, and I can declare this because the accounts were at company's house, it lost nearly £3 million.
Mm-hmm.
In 22 and 23, it made consecutive EBITDAs of £30 million.
Wow, what a turnaround.
Now that, I mean, that gives you a buzz. It's an absolute full time. I did that. I finished that one in July,
uh-huh,
and I was full time in that business for nearly 4 years.
Two things that you've flagged there, mm-hmm, that I think, Mark, we should, mm-hmm, just briefly reflect on, if I may. So obviously, you've mentioned that you've been involved in a number of projects and, mm-hmm, working with businesses,
yep,
on a fractional basis, be it as a CEO, be it as chair or non-executive director, I guess, title to, mm-hmm, one side. How do you now manage to make sure you have congruence when fundamentally you are creating value for the people economically? How do you manage to achieve that? Because, of course, the business you, mm-hmm, referenced there, you know, you, mm-hmm, turned around a material business,
mm-hmm,
to create value for someone who perhaps may, in certain instances, not that one specifically, be part of the problem. So how do you get congruence in that situation?
I'm not cheap. So I make sure I get a good rate.
Good.
Yeah, that's important, I think. Because if they don't realize that that's what they're paying for, you should be there anyway.
Exactly.
And then it's how engaged you need to be in terms of, do you have the freedom to make the changes that you think are necessary?
Yeah.
And when you do that, sometimes they're a bit risky, sometimes they're quite obvious, the changes you have to make. But when they then start to work and you can see the returns, that is the bit that you enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, it really is good fun. Yeah.
And I don't want to talk specifically about any one of the projects,
yeah,
part that you've been involved in, because I appreciate confidentiality is important. But just to ask one question, if there was one thing that you can share with our viewers. What is the one thing that you have been able to introduce,
yeah,
to a distressed business that has had the most demonstrable immediate impact, acknowledging, I'm sure there's many, but what would be the one thing you would say each and every time seems to be a consistent problem, challenge?
To answer that question, I've got to sort of do it indirectly.
Please do.
In as much as the projects that I've enjoyed have been a mixture of privately owned businesses and VC-backed businesses. And that dynamic is more than subtly different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Privately owned businesses, the owners, shareholders, have been there a long time. Yeah. And largely, the problems they face, generalizing deliberately, a fact that the businesses haven't moved with the times for whatever reason,
right,
whether it be people development, whether it be training, retention, but understanding how the business is run and is it relevant to today's dynamics, as it were. With VC investment, the due diligence that most venture capitalists do are generally very good when it comes to the technology or the product or whatever. Where they generally have problems is with people. And if it's high-tech businesses, the mistakes that are normally made are the assumption that high-tech, whether it be, techies or whether it be engineers, are naturally good businessmen. And there's a great deal of investment needed, not just cash, but time and energy into, restructuring a business, but make sure that the training, development, and retention of talent is essential. We talked earlier about what I did within Prominex is making sure that second and even third tier management are being indulged to make sure that the business grows.
Now,
mine was a service business, so that you would say that is obvious. But even businesses with good tech or good products or whatever, there would be nothing without people. Until AI takes the world over, people are essential. And I think a lot of people miss that in terms of how you can actually change your business's fortune. You're talking about cultural changes. You're definitely talking about possibly recruitment, being brave enough to replace people, but essentially spotting talent and developing it is the key to any successful business.
And I guess it must be really difficult going into a large business and trying to encourage the shareholders to see their business that they may have founded through a new lens.
Yeah, very difficult.
How do you do that other than to subtly and precisely highlight deficiency? Other than that, how do you get people to see things through your lens?
You don't always. One, again, because I don't want to broadcast names, one business I looked after needed at least £2 million to invest in it, to bring it from where it was to where it potentially could go.
Mm-hmm.
The owner weren't willing to do that. So we tried to buy it, management buyout.
Okay.
The declined.
The
shareholders. The owners declined and sold it to a VC.
Okay.
Yeah. And it didn't last 2 years.
Really?
Yeah.
The business failed.
Yeah. Which I was immensely disappointed about because I'd been with it for 2 years. It was in the Northeast, so I'm virtually giving it away. But yeah, you don't always succeed. And that's what, when you get involved with turnarounds, you've got to be prepared to not always succeed. And that's the toughest part of it, I think.
And why is it you found yourself, Mark, being involved in a number of turnaround projects? Because some people would perhaps intentionally not look toward those opportunities.
No, exactly.
Because of the risk of failure.
It all started the 9 months after my retirement. And I got approached by LDC, Lloyds Development Capital. And I was asked, would I take on an exec chair position? And they explained the difference because I was naive to the subtle difference. But the exec chair position meant that they wanted me to go in, sort certain problems out, and help them sell the business. And I did that in 12 months. Thoroughly enjoyed it. LDC were pleased. The new acquirer was pleased. The manager were pleased. And I thought to myself, I really enjoyed that. Because I think I told you earlier in a previous conversation, I didn't really have any desire to get into the NED world, to be honest. Because I've seen what good looks like. I've also seen what bad looks like. And I thought to myself, is it really for me? And would I be bad because I'm too hands-on and I want to get involved? And the guy that hooked me, Simon Adcock, he was ex-Deloitte as well, said, in this case, we want you to get involved. So that's why I think
it's the executive chair piece.
And that's the subtlety. And he said, we want you to get involved to sort the particular problems out and help us sell it. And I really enjoyed it. Yeah. And then it's just referrals. People just picking the phone and say, could you have a look at this, Mark? And that's how I got into the recycling business. Just a lawyer friend who was in HR, had this company as a client and was observing that pre-COVID, there's some huge problems kicking off here with the whole team resigning. Have you got time and the capacity to come and have a look at it?
You mentioned, Mar, that there is, in your opinion, a material difference between a highly experienced, additive, capable, non-executive director and other individuals who may purport to be non-executive directors. So for the benefit of our viewers, you may for the first time be appointing a non-exec or even a chair. Can you just provide an insight into how they would go about fundamentally establishing what good looks like?
Yeah. Well, the obvious ones, just take references. You know, is this individual's at the first NED position, or have they done this previously? And it's dead easy to pick the phone up and discuss the performance of this individual with previous businesses. And I'm pleased to say now there's a lot more diligence around that whole piece, and as much as, you know, there's training to be had for NEDs now, there's huge networks where they do consciously look at training and development of NEDs, because there's an awareness now of what value, and it can be tremendous value, that a good chair stroke non-exec director can bring to a business. So I think you're wheedling out the individuals that were just on it as a gravy train, for want of a better expression. So I think your likelihood of finding the right people, given, you know, social media and referencing, is you've stand a better chance now, to be fair.
And I guess the point you made earlier, which is worth just adding as well, is if a business is to become VCT or PE backed, then of course those financial investors will have form in appreciating which chairs and NXDs may have been successful previous businesses they've invested in. So perhaps that's also
helpful. I think that's essential.
So obviously, with one eye on time, Mark, because I think you and I could talk for a lot longer, but sadly, our time on this podcast, at least, is going to come to an end shortly. So just one question before we move on to the final section of the discussion. So obviously, you've mentioned that you've worked with a variety of businesses, some highly successful, some turnarounds, some have become successful, and some have gone into administration. So can you just tell me a little bit about, I guess, the thing that you have learned yourself from working with these businesses in different guys that you wish you had known when you founded your business way back when? That may have materially changed, ultimately, the way you build that business from scratch.
I think the psychological aspect of enjoying that role, whether it be CEO, whether it be non-exec or chairman, the psychology around satisfying a quite diverse group of stakeholders, and I'm not just alluding to investors, but lots of people around businesses have different ideas as to how they want to see their business run, have different ideas of what success looks like, and negotiating the psychology around those individuals is something that probably comes with age and experience. Whereas in the early days, I was far too confrontational when we fell out of board meetings with, you know, sovereign capital. It was the baptism of fire, for God's sakes. And yeah, you think you know it all, and you don't. And as much as you might know your business well, but you're not very good at managing these people, Mark. And that took time.
Yes.
It took a lot of time. But that journey probably is what I bring the most value now. And as much as I thoroughly understand the dynamic in terms of being a diplomat, really, between various stakeholders. Because inevitably, if you're getting into a situation where the asset is distressed, there's tension.
That's right.
Yeah, always. And the language between the various stakeholders is always different. And as much as it can be interpreted totally different ways. And I've got one now where a big investor, private investor, and a private equity investor and a management team just simply aren't on the same page. And that's what I'm trying to achieve now. And say, look, guys, you all want the same thing. You're just approaching it more than subtly different. So let's start again. Just purely from that.
Well, I think that sort of wisdom, that experience, that hindsight, you know, call it what you will, Mark, is really important. Because actually, when you were saying that, I was sort of just thinking about lots of businesses that I'm currently advising on, fundraisers or private equity refinancing projects. And you're right, the one thing that seems to be the biggest challenge is all around acknowledging typically an equity investor, founder, shareholder group, an SMT want the same thing, which is a highly successful business.
Absolutely.
That has value because everybody will succeed as a consequence. Yet sometimes that is forgotten. And I think some of it is just the way each stakeholder chooses to communicate or not.
And of course, there's no playbook for that.
Well, there is no playbook. No. And you know, you've referenced sovereign capital. So, you know, I guess sovereign capital as a private equity house is one PE house. They have an approach. They will have a typical sort of expectation and they'll have a style. I guess that is quite different to an LDC, which you reference.
Yep.
So again, I think it's really important, isn't it, that viewers who may be contemplating securing equity investment do receive advice to understand the different types of equity investor that exists, because there are two extremes to that same spectrum, right?
And of course, they're investing other people's money.
Well, that's right.
So the degree
they are accountable.
The diligence and the governance is probably higher than you would expect as well. Yeah.
Sure.
So a lot of them think, they're just going to write the check and then they're going to walk away and wait for the return.
No, well, some funds that have deployment targets may take that approach. Hence this misconception, but, you know, private equity funds that are deploying money on behalf of others expect a return on investment. I mean, surprise, surprise. So as you say, stakeholder management is really important. And actually knowing a little bit about, you know, the true objectives of the stakeholders is also vital.
Yeah, totally.
So obviously you try to retire unsuccessfully, Mark, albeit to the benefit of the many business that you've been able to advise. And, what does the future look like for Mark?
More of the same. As I say, up until July, I was with the recycler for 4 years. And you then have the conversation again, don't you? Do you want to stop? Do you want to retire? And we both said, my wife and I, you can't. And it's probably a stronger desire now, having had that massive turnaround,
yes,
to keep doing it. I'm trying consciously to do it closer to home. So I'm specifically looking at building a portfolio in the Northeast so I can get home most evenings.
And these will be NED and chair type assignments?
Yeah. Or interim CEO roles. Okay. I'm open to any of those. The clear caveat being that I've got to understand and believe I can add value.
Totally.
If not, it's not for me. And I probably say no to as many as I say yes to. So
yeah. Sure. And I mean, that's really inspiring. Obviously, a lot of the shareholder groups and boards that you work with, you know, you will often be encouraging them to be a bit more precise as to what their medium-term aspirations are.
Totally.
So I'm going to have to ask one final question, which is, do you think there'll ever be a time where you will conclude that perhaps you do fundamentally want to retire?
Yeah.
Or can you just not see that far ahead?
I'm not planning it because it infers that I'll start to be coming into decline, i.e. old age is catching up with me.
Yeah.
So would you contemplate that? No way.
Well, and here lies the importance of perspective, because for you, retirement equals decline and lack of activity.
Yeah.
Actually, speaking sort of personally, so my father retired when he was 55, and he said that his life started at 56, which is fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
Because that's just perspective.
Yeah.
Totally. People got different priorities and interests.
Yeah.
But I totally appreciate you, Mark, that business and being able to create value, it's your purpose and something you enjoy to do.
Totally enjoy it.
And therefore, I can see why retirement would make your toenails curve inside out.
Yeah. Yeah.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
Mark, thank you. It's been a really interesting, inspiring, thought-provoking conversation. I'm sure our viewers will take an awful lot from this. And I hope that I never, for the right reasons, come across any of your father's artwork, because that would only create embarrassment for everybody, more so yourself. But for now, Mark, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's been brilliant having Mark Dixon on our Confessions of a CEO podcast today. For me, the key takeaways from today's podcast are the importance of making sure stakeholders that are sitting around a business are managed, acknowledging, truth be told, every stakeholder will have one thing in common, which is the success of a business. But it's fantastic and also interesting to hear how many times those stakeholders can perhaps lack congruence, often as a direct consequence of poor communication or, dare I say, lack of communication. It's been really interesting to hear a little bit about Mark's early career and some of the things that has inspired him to want to not only achieve in his own career, but also to help others achieve their true potential. Mark's inability to retire is something that I not only respect, but fully understand. And for sure, it is great to see how many businesses Mark has been able to support, advise, and assist, both as interim CEO, exec chair, non-exec chair, and indeed NED. You can download this podcast on social media or indeed wherever you get your podcasts from. But for now, my name is Carl Swansbury. You've been watching Confessions of a CEO, and we look forward to seeing you on future Confessions of a CEO podcasts.